This podcast is a part of the Newhoff Media Podcast Network.
Back here on a Wednesday, good morning and welcome. Wayne Kent joins the program after a couple of weeks off. Have you been traveling?
We have been, Brian. Good morning. We had a couple of weeks vacation, actually. Straight up 2 weeks vacation. It was a wonderful experience. We spent 2 weeks out at the beach. We have this little island we've been going out to off the coast of North Carolina for some, 20, 25 years. It's called Topsail Island. And so we went out and spent a week, Leslie and I, by ourselves, and the kids all joined us. Wonderful. I think I'd do it the other way around next time. Have the kids go with us at first, then take a week to rest after that.
I got it. Life is busy, even in relaxation. Well, welcome back. I'll tell you, it is interesting. I don't know where we are in your countdown to retirement. You've told me a number of times, and for whatever reason, I keep forgetting. When is it that you're officially done?
It's still a ways off. It's off in June of next year.
All right, so yeah, we got plenty of time.
We're 8 or 9 months away at this point. Yeah, so it's not. I think people, because of the nature of my profession, if you will, it's helpful for people to know way in advance. So it's probably a longer lineup than what you would have in other professions. So perhaps that's one reason why it's like, is this never ending? Well, from the perspective of other people like you, it probably is, yes.
All right. No, I didn't mean any judgment by it. I can't keep that stuff in my brain. I don't know why. All right. So what's the countdown like? Is there a short timer syndrome that jumps in? You know, I mean, are you showing up 15 minutes late for church? What happens?
Actually, it's been very interesting. So we informed the congregation in January of this year that I had an 18-month run, and indicating that by the time we got to the fall, they would start to notice the difference. And really that kicked in, it really kicks in this week, so to speak, in that after I was gone, the fellow who was taking me my place, Brian Talty, he had some time away this summer as well. So now we're both back in the office, and from the perspective of the congregation, they will start seeing him, if you will, on stage. They'll start seeing his face more than mine throughout the next few months. It'll become even more apparent in the new year. It's kind of I've never danced this dance before, so I've got to learn a lot, but it is a dance to try to figure out how to make it work in a way that seems natural and right and has some integrity to it for the congregation, right? And, hi, it's nice to see you. Bye. I mean, you do. By the time we're done with the 29 years of life with this congregation, that's a lot of life moments, you know, marrying and burying and baptizing. Those are all life stories that you just don't want to walk away from. Not that I would, but how do we make it so it doesn't feel like that? That's part of the issue.
All right. It's interesting. Do pastors get more time off than the average Joe?
No, I would say no.
I don't know, man. You guys get sabbaticals and vacations. I would just say anecdotally, it seems like you do.
It feels that way, perhaps, yeah, but we do not know. Actually, I think most pastors work a lot of hours. I mean, you if you're going to be, if you will, using the word successful, I don't know how to exactly define that, but most of us are working 50, 60 hours a week. In like in our schedule, in terms of employees, you come in and work at First Christian Church. The first year you work, you get a week's vacation. 2 or 3 years in, you get 2 weeks. You know, it moves like that. The difference is that perhaps we follow a different schedule in the sabbatical. Every 7 years, we get a sabbatical of 3 months to retool. It's helpful for the congregation because if you think about it, a lot of churches, they get a new pastor every 5 to 6 years, mostly because the pastor is kind of worn out at that point. And a sabbatical is very cost-effective, straight up from a financial point of view, very cost-effective for the church. Say, go take 3 months. Instead of going to a new church, take 3 months, go figure out the next step of your ministry life and how our church could benefit from that. So from the perspective of the congregation, it's very, very helpful.
Okay, so that's every 7 years then, you said?
Yep.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, in our case, it's 7 years in and every 5 years thereafter. But I had like 6.5 years between the one I took in 2014 and the one I took last year. I just didn't feel like, you know, I was due at 5 years in, so it should have been in 2019, and I went to the leaders of the church and said, I don't think I'm ready. I don't think the church is ready. I have this sense that something's coming in 2020 that I need to be more engaged in, so I don't take a sabbatical right now. As it turned out, that was very fortuitous because, you know, before running sabbatical, we got hit with COVID. So Yeah, I know it feels like part of it is just you and I have done a lot of long life together at this point. I've been on the air 16 years, so you've
been around
long enough for them to all keep coming along.
No, listen, this is not a judgment question. I'm just curious. I think it's ministers and it's, you know, college professors. I don't know why it's not more in use if the benefits, like you suggested, are there, why more companies or businesses don't do that. I mean, it's very unique.
It is unique. I think because it's, how can we say this? It's so out of the box for businesses to think we could, how would we do life without that person in that job for, say, 13 weeks? What happens is when you don't have that person in that job for 13 weeks, you figure out, oh, maybe we need to do this, this, and this because we could put this person here. And it's not like you're working yourself out of a job, but you go, the rest of the team around you goes, hey, we can cover this, which then you come back and there's this whole new space of people have learned. They've taken over some of my responsibilities while I'm gone. They learn things. I learn things. It is unbelievably positive. There's never been a moment where you go, and just put it straight up, you know, if I will, for mental health, for the actual individual. It's so healthy. So it's not 3 months rest. I need to make that very clear. We do say we want you to get 4 weeks of rest in the sabbatical. And then we want you to go study and prepare and go to school, go take classes or whatever for the following 2 months and retool for the future.
Yeah. Listen, once again, I'm not judging. It just seems so alien to me. Like, I'm quite convinced if I took 13 weeks off, I wouldn't have a job.
Well, I understand that, but that's where the company has to come behind you and say, okay, no, you've got a job. Good luck on that, right?
Yeah, they could say that, but I'm just telling you, they'd figure out how to do it without me. All right, what's coming up tonight at 5 o'clock?
Well, it's interesting you're talking about mental health. September is National Suicide Prevention Month, and so we've got a gentleman who's in ministry who moved very, very close to attempting suicide. Suicide in clergy is sadly, a growing phenomena. And it's probably, you know, as you are aware, mental health issues across the board throughout the last 18 months since the pandemic hit are just through the roof. And so we're going to be taking a look at that to see what brought him to the point where he was contemplating suicide and what has he learned on the backside of this since he's gone public with his story. Because, you know, being a preacher and saying I had a fascination with suicide or some contemplation in that regard, that might be a job killing move. So how has he survived that?
Why would that be? Ministers or clergy be exempt from the numbers of mental health in this country and around the world? Why would they be exempt from that?
We're not.
Okay, then why would admitting that you had suicidal thoughts or tendencies be a job killer?
Well, in the sense that congregations, be it falsely, have this expect. We know, us preachers, believe it or not, I know all the mess that goes on with preachers when we go do things poorly or badly or fall off the stool that we're on. But there's the problem. We're on this stool that people expect us to have lives that are so uniquely different from theirs. Sitting in the pew, you know, we are put on a high pedestal. And I don't like it one bit. Because I have certainly areas of my life where you go, hey, if you only knew. And so you try to be transparent with the congregation. I don't know. If you'd only been at a church, say, for a year and you announced that you'd had problems with suicidal tendencies, they might keep you, but you might also be out of a job.
All right. This is where the Christianity thing doesn't stack up for me, because it is this idea that somehow or anyone else is in an elevated position as your relationship to God versus the people sitting in the pews, and that you're somehow not a human being. I don't understand that at all.
Well, I think that's a reasonable call, Brian. Absolutely. Like this week, I'm going to talk about our prayer life and how sometimes, you know, if you're familiar with this walrus in Ireland that keeps landing on people's boats, he's in the harbor in a harbor in Ireland. He keeps lumbering and climbing on people's boats, and they almost sink and everything. And they don't know where he's going to come up. You know, so he goes underwater for 10 minutes, then he comes up, and then he's getting on board a boat. It's a hilarious story. And yet, frankly, that's sometimes how I feel with regards to prayer. You know, I'm supposed to be a professional prayer. if you guys have a, if the city has a civic event, sometimes they'll call and say, Wayne, were you coming off of the, you know, the invocation? And you're paid. You're the one who knows how to pray. And you'd have to be honest and say, I'm like everybody else. There are moments when I'm going, I feel like Wally the Walrus. I'm down underneath for a long time. Then I come up and I go, I don't know how to pray. And I'm lumbering around to get on this boat and figure it out. I'm just this big, fat thing that weighs a ton and trying to figure out, how do you do prayer? And yet we're supposed to be the professional prayer. So that applies to every situation in life. Every, you know, within ministry, there's people who struggle with mental health. As a matter of fact, it's might be my opinion that those of us in the caring profession of ministry probably have greater emotional and mental health issues than perhaps even the general population because of the type of people who go into ministry, the personalities of ministry. That's probably another matter. But yeah, we have financial troubles. We have issues in our marriages. We have issues in our education. We are straight up people. And you're right. You're exactly right. At times, it is the church that is the most judgmental, sadly.
Yeah. I expect you to have all of the downside of being a human being that all of us have. I'd ask you not to steal, you know, money from old ladies who are buying cat food to supplement their diet so you can have an air-conditioned doghouse. You know, outside of that, I think you're just a normal human being.
We are. As a matter of fact, as an aside, you may be aware that we are responsible for spiritual care of what happens at DMH. And we recently won a grant in order to deal with the mental health from a spiritual perspective of the frontline workers. We have people in the buildings throughout the day, but we have recently moved one of our staff members to an evening and nighttime position specifically to care for staff, not just patients. Patients are sleeping at night, but we are moving much of our resources to evening and nighttime because people in the hospital are also sort of in the same boat though under COVID, even more so than those of us in ministry, on this pressure cooker. So this issue of mental health, what we'll deal with tonight, I think, applies not only to people in ministry, but those in the caring professions, particularly maybe we are more at risk. I don't know. We'll find out.
Interesting. We've got to change the way we treat it, though. Wayne, I was mentioning earlier, you know, the technology can help. I mean, you know, I truly do believe that there will be a day where your iPhone can recognize depression. You know, in the way that you're typing text, in the way that your face looks, in the way that, you know, expressions. I mean, I really do believe that. But we haven't changed the way we care for people in like 75 years.
I would agree. So we're as a congregation, we're trying to step into that, specifically with, as I said, for those who are on the front line in the medical community at DMA in the nighttime and evenings. I have spent time in the hospital throughout the night at various points throughout my ministry work here in the city, and it's tough in the middle of the night.
Oh, mental health isn't a Monday through Friday 9-to-5 thing, that's for sure.
No, not by any means.
Glad that you're
I'd be interested. What are the type of personalities of people that work in radio, and how are their mental health? You don't need to particularly answer that for you personally, but there are particular characteristics of different professions, I think, of personalities, and what is the susceptibility in different professions to mental health? I have no idea if there's a study out there, but I'd find that fascinating.
Maybe. I don't know. It is an interesting concept. We can't talk about it enough. I mean, obviously, it was such a stigma for so long. Still is, evidently, in some churches, based on your description, you know, of what a new pastor might deal with by being honest about mental health issues. And I think that's part of the problem. People are still embarrassed or there's a stigma attached. They don't talk about it. It impacts so many people. If you just do the math, the numbers are there. And we're getting better, I think. But, I've lived in a lifetime where we used to say the C word or we'd whisper cancer. I don't understand why we as people have these stigmas attached to these things.
This is just a question I might have. During the Black Plague is when, I want to be careful how I speak for Roman Catholicism, is when Roman Catholics developed the idea that suicide was an unforgivable sin that automatically sent you to hell. That is still part of Catholic doctrine. And so consequently, if you were to commit suicide and be Roman Catholic, as I understand it, the local priest could not perform a funeral for you in the church. The reason that came about was because so many people were committing suicide rather than face the Black Plague death. They'd say, well, let's just all commit suicide. So the church said, if you do that in an effort to push against those suicides, you're committing yourself to hell. I can't get there on that theologically. I've done many funerals of people who've committed suicide, and it is the most tragic and difficult of all the funerals you do. Even if you've, I've buried little babies, and fair enough, those are gut-wrenching. But when somebody commits suicide, there are so many questions that are never answered. And those families are back in my office, you know, various points throughout the years that follow up with unresolved grief. It's awful.
Yeah, the doctrine that it says to me that the people who jumped out of the World Trade Center rather than burning to death are going to hell, I'd rather be in hell sometimes when I hear the descriptions of who's going to make which cut.
I have no sense of how that, even under the people who would say that suicide is you know, a damning, if you will, eternally damning event. I don't understand the 9/11 people that they're saying, well, they committed suicide. Oh, no, they didn't. They were thrown out of that building. They had no choice. You burn alive or you jump in the hope that you might live.
It's the problem when you draw these tight little boxes, man. Life doesn't fit in it. And that's just sort of the way it works. All right. Anything else tonight at 5?
Well, we're going to look at a number of things. Obviously, I want to have a chat about where we are with the vaccine and that sort of stuff. We've obviously passed over the last few days the number of people who have died who are now greater than the 1918 flu pandemic. There's so much to think about in regards to what to do with COVID. We're not through it by any means. It's going to be around for a long time. It continues to impact congregations, both. I'll just say it straight up. Because of the circles, if you will, of where I've landed in my theology, there are people who would share my theology. Many of them are anti-vaxxers. And I'm starting to see a greater number of them die.
Yeah.
And that has not freaking me out, but I really want to go, how silly is this? You have an opportunity to save your life and to save someone else's life. And yet, because you've bought into some political ideology that doesn't make any sense to me, I'm concerned about that. So we'll probably address that tonight.
I mean, the Pope's puzzled about it. I mean, everyone is. I don't know if you saw that story, and the religious exemption side of this is very interesting to me. This has been a tiny fraction of people for all of my lifetime. And now everyone and their brother is now saying, nope, I want a religious exemption. Do you have a clear take on what that realistically is?
So on the way back from vacation from North Carolina, we spent a couple of days in Nashville at a conference for, for pastors of larger churches. And it's a round table discussion saying somebody will present a question and you're at a table with a bunch of people who are all pastors of large churches because the dynamics of what we deal with perhaps are different than smaller church staffing, budgets, buildings, all that sort of thing. And the question was presented, what are your plans when people ask for religious exemptions? And could I tell you this? There was no consensus around the table I was at. And I'm sitting at a table with people who have like 40,000 or 35,000 people in their church, 14,000 in their church, big, big churches. And they're saying, one guy said, yeah, I've already had 5 or 6 of these religious exemption requests. In other words, people asking for letters to exempt them from a religious point of view. And no one around the table would say this is good theology. But on the other hand, if a person claims to have that this is my religious viewpoint, I don't know that I could write the letter. I'll just put it that way.
The CEO of Conway Regional Health System sent to their staff because they had an unusual, you know, versus just the past history about vaccines, people requesting religious exemptions because of the use of fetal cell lines. And he sent them back a letter saying, okay, but you're going to have to give up Tylenol, Pepto-Bismol, Tums, Lipitor, ibuprofen, Motrin, Maalox, Ex-Lac, Benadryl, Sudafed. All these things were created with the exact same science.
Well, first of all, let's be clear that not all. So we have three. We have J&J, we have Pfizer, we have Moderna. at least two of them do not come from those cell lines. But even if they did, and you know how pro-life I am, Brian. I mean, my wife works at New Life Pregnancy Center. We are, there's very few families that have laid it on the line as we have for, in terms of our understanding of abortion and the right to life, okay? But having said that, even if some of those lines were used to create these medicines, I want to go, what was meant for evil has now been used for good. Let's land there. Let's land where, okay, so that evil may have occurred back in 1976 or 69 or wherever it was, and yet what has come out of that has been good. So I'm not letting the end justify the means or anything like that. But on the other hand, I'm going, even if that, acknowledging with every fiber of my being that that is evil, I'm still going to say, well, what? Look at how we can save lives today.
Yes, but
and I
but
know
why,
that's very slippery and very scary.
No, I understand it, but no one's having this conversation about a bottle of Tylenol.
Well, fair enough. Yeah.
So it's convenient religious exemption because you're buying into the politics of this pandemic.
There you go. I would agree absolutely.
All right, Wayne.
It's all really really hard stuff. Life is our present. Culture is full of these very, very complex matters, and trying to dumb it down is not helpful. But I'm aware that, man, the choices we have to make these days are very, very hard. On this particular one, I think it's a fairly easy choice.
Yeah, we're making it harder than we have to. There's no doubt.
I agree.
All
yeah,
right, Wayne,
absolutely.
We'll see you tonight at 5. Great to being with you, having you back after a couple of weeks. Wow, we packed a lot into there.
You've been listening to the Newhoff Media Podcast Network. For more, visit newhoffmedia.com.